Good morning, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is Eric Clay in the Made of Clay Report, and you're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca at 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen, also streaming at WRFI.org. In the second hour today, we have as a guest Kathy Luce Herrera. Today, I just by coincidence happened to be able to have two people who are running for a county legislator in the second district, which is largely Fall Creek, and I don't know how much bigger than Fall Creek it is. I don't remember. But Kathy, it's good to have you here for this second hour. We had Patty Sittman the first hour, and we're going to have the same set of questions and just continue to explore who you are as a person and what you care about and how we can get to know some of the, you know, some of the challenges or some of the ways you've grown and changed over the years. Okay?
Thanks. It's great to be here on community radio today.
Good to have you. And right now, as we start each of these shows, we're gonna have the playlist from Kathy, and that playlist today includes we're gonna start with a Linda Ronstadt song, El Sol de Tu Eres.
Muy colorado como una rueda de cobre de diario me estás mirando de para repartir tu luz. Habías de enseñarle al amor a ser lo mismo.
Was Linda Ronstadt and El Sol de Tu Eres. Okay, I wanted to change a word in there, but I wanted to get in front of me what I was actually saying. Kathy, tell me a little bit about what the pieces of the mosaic are that make up your life. Give us a picture of who you are.
Well, first I want to talk about that song because
it's
a Linda Ronstadt song. It's a folk song that's in the public domain, and it's probably more than 100 years old. And what's cool about that song is it's kind of a labor song, and it's very simple. It talks about the sun in the sky looks like a copper circle, and you see me in the fields, something like maybe you can tell my boss to be like you, shining on me, or something like that. But it's very simple, and the way Linda sings it, she's got her phrasing. You know, she's a terrific singer.
And the translation of the title, El Sol de Tu Eres, how do you translate that?
The sun that you are.
The sun that you are. Yeah. Or the sun of your being.
That's even better.
It was because I wanted to say ketu, but it's de tu eres, and so it's more of being, which is profound. Now, what of your being? Who are you?
It's really fun to talk about yourself, but then when you ask a profound question like that, it's scary. But actually, who I am is pretty simple. It's a lot like who anybody is. You know, I'm the sum of my experiences, and you put that together with my aspirations and with, you know, my successes and my failures and the people around me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, specifically, I know you want to know things.
Yeah. But it's a picture that you make and not the picture that others make of you. And I think that's important because a lot of times we don't get that privilege in our culture mm-hmm. to define who we are.
Well, I've been very lucky in my life. I was born in the 50s to a family that was active in the civil rights movement. We moved into a mostly white neighborhood when I was about 5 years old. And throughout the time I was growing up, I was steeped in politics. We went to the polls on election day, and we'd dress up and stand in Texas. It's a tradition, kind of, you stand outside the polling place, just outside the barrier with...
outside the 100 feet or however many.
Yeah, with cards for your candidate. And I passed out cards for JFK and for people in local judges' races. And, of course, my folks made a point of taking us, not all at the same time, of course, mm-hmm. into the polling booth to vote. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with an understanding that voting is really important and that government is something we can all participate in and expect it to be serving everyone.
So your political legs were your some of your earliest legs, as it were, in terms of how you live this life, how you walk this life. What are some other things about you that would be helpful for us to know who you are as you wish to be known?
I used to play fast pitch softball. I won't say a triple threat. I played basketball in those days. Girls played half court. I was a guard.
Right.
And my favorite sport, well, my best sport was volleyball. Mm-hmm. It was about the time that power volleyball was coming in. And mm-hmm. I really didn't have a power volleyball serve, but I was a real good set. Uh-huh. And I always enjoyed sports.
Yeah,
and,
neat.
I came out early as a lesbian. And at the time, it wasn't very common. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky. And that's one of the things that stuck with me through my life is the relative privilege and... good fortune that I've had.
And how did it come to be that you came out early? What prompted that kind of openness at an early stage in the process?
All I can say is you just know. I mean,
mm-hmm. Well, not that you know, but that you were willing to be known. That's a different question.
Yeah, it's because of kind of the way I was raised. You know, my dad had been a as a kid growing up in a family of migrant workers. He also did shoe shines, mm-hmm, sold papers. Mm-hmm. He was a taxi driver at night after he and my mom got married. And we would, at the dinner table, we would sit and chat, and he'd listen to what we were talking about the school day or whatever. And then he'd say whatever the opposite of the side was that we were on.
Uh-huh.
He would ask us to take that side on. And I think in a discussion... And I kind of didn't like it at the time. It was a discipline that took time to grow on me, but it has to do with being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and critical thinking.
Right. Now, I'm the sixth of seven kids on a subsistence farm family in North Missouri. And my father and mother would have after dinner, they would host after dinner debates or where we would basically take on the issues of the day. And my dad presided at those in a very similar sort of way. I don't know if he was as explicit about taking opposite sides, but when you've got seven children, there are going to be different sides coming out mm-hmm. Along the way. One of the things that... So it teaches people to be out there with their lives and with their opinions, which I think is what your point is. Also, one of the things that's interesting about Ithaca that a lot of people don't fully appreciate, or maybe even know, it's been in the papers, but outside of Manhattan and New York County, Manhattan is New York County. It's one of the boroughs in the city. Ithaca has the second highest number of gay and lesbian-headed, percentage of gay and lesbian-headed households in New York State. So it's an enclave of a concentration next only to Manhattan, and we often don't think of ourselves in that light. I don't know if that's something you were aware of or not.
Not when I came here.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you have
one of the things I love about Ithaca and Tompkins County mm-hmm. is you're free to bring your whole self to any endeavor, and that was what I've always sought as an individual, you know, and a member of a community, is to be able to bring my whole self. And I guess that's what coming out early was for me, was, you know, having to be totally who I am, and it makes up a lot of different parts, and one of them is sexual orientation.
And in making those connections of being out there and being known, we're going to switch to this Mary Chapin Carpenter song called Grand Central Station.
Awesome.
Got my work clothes on, full of sweat and dirt. All this holy dust upon my face and shirt. Heading uptown now, just as the shifts are changing to Grand Central Station. I've got my lunchbox, got my hard hat in my hand. I ain't no hero, mister, just a working all these voices keep on asking me to take them to Grand Central Station. Grand Central Station. I wanna stand beneath the clock just one more time. Wanna wait upon the platform for the Hudson line. I guess you're never really all alone, or too far from the pull of home, and the stars upon that painted dome still shine. I made my way out on the 42nd Street. I lit a cigarette and stared down at my feet. Imagined all the ones that ever stood here waiting at Grand Central Station. Grand Central Station.
Was Mary Chapin Carpenter and Grand Central Station. And our guest at this hour is Kathy Luce Herrera. And you want to say a bit about Grand Central Station as a song?
Well, I love Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Uh-huh.
What I love about that song is it's got some working people images in it. And living in New York, as I have now for, 25 years, there's a way that 9/11 affected anybody really who's mm-hmm. been here in a profound way, and it's something that you really can't, it's hard for people to understand the depth of it, and I think that Mary Chapin Carpenter does it in a terrific way with that song.
Right, it's so low key and so just kind of the words just carry the meaning on mm-hmm. their own. So tell me, what brought you here to this area from Texas or wherever else you've traveled? I don't know your and also what keeps you here. But what brought you here?
Well, I first came here after a women's music festival that I was doing set up for Michigan Women's Music Festival, and some friends of mine after the festival said, "Let's all get together and go to this beautiful place, and we'll just jam and play music and have fun," and. Sounded good. I, for the first time in my adult life, was off of work on just by a kind of a whim and a set of circumstances, and I figured I might not be off of work again. I spent the summer here, and I met my partner, Jill. Mm-hmm. We've been together for over 30 years now.
Wow.
It's funny, when you meet somebody, I was saying, you just know.
Right.
I just knew. But even back then, you know, you can't just say to somebody, well, you're the one. So we had a long-distance relationship for quite a while. She came to Texas for about 6 weeks, and then I came up to New York for about 6 weeks. At that time, the one ads were like less than a third of a column long, and I knew it would be difficult to get work, but just being in the city here, it's so perfect because it's rural, it's urban, and it's beautiful.
Yes.
I live 3 blocks from the Ithaca Falls, well, maybe 5 blocks, and 2 blocks from Cascadilla Creek. And I can have that and wildlife and working up at Cornell. I see foxes and beavers and great blues. And, you know, sometimes you see people with their scopes set up early in the morning. And you can, you know, real quietly go up to them, and they'll show you the bird they're looking at that's on their bird list. You know, it's just like, it's such a great mix of ag and intellectual, you know.
It's it's a really hard community to nail down because we look so rural, and yet we haven't been a dominant agricultural county for decades, or probably a century. One of the greatest agricultural universities in the world was founded here, but it's on the northern edge of some of the poorest farmland in the U.S. To the northern edge, it's quite wonderful, but to the south, it's quite dicey. Unless you're doing forest agriculture, which we're learning more and more about how to do after we've kind of stripped the land and kind of let it come back to trees. I just want to explore one thing. Coming here as a Latina woman, Chicana, I don't know what term you prefer, if you prefer a term at all, but Ithaca in 1980, 81 would have only been 2 or 3% Latino in terms of the Tompkins County area. It's nearly doubled in size in the 30 years since then. How has that been for you to come into this place of where the minority is so tiny compared to where you've been?
Well, by way of illustration, I'll say that I've pretty much lived in predominantly white culture my whole life.
Even when you moved into the neighborhood, you were 10 as a child.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
okay.
It's you know, I can have friends and family from lots of different walks of life, and to me that's a full life. In Texas, I called myself Chicana because, you know, that's what I am.
That's the term
but
in Texas,
too.
But
I came up here, and I was told and realized that it's true. Latina is a more inclusive term. I like inclusive, so I can have both. I can hold both of those at the same time.
Yes.
So I can't remember the third part of your question.
Well, you know, you answered it partly, but what are some of the things that keep you here? You know, we live in a world, particularly in Ithaca, with half of the population having migrated in since 1950. In terms of their population level, we have a regular turnover of about a third of it being students, undergraduate and graduate students. But we doubled in size from 1950 to the present, and people come and go. What keeps you here?
Well, my partner and I, when we decided that we would, you know, make a life together, we traveled around the country for probably about six months, and we had a little pop-up camper that was on the back of the truck, and I love that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We went to a lot of national parks, but we were also thinking at the time that we would look at the women's communities because they were of interest, and there were a whole lot of them then. We visited a bunch of them. We kept coming back to Ithaca. We went around a couple of times, and every time we came back to Ithaca and thought, you know, this has everything that we want. It's got a lot of art and culture for a city its size. Mm-hmm. It's not so huge that you can't get around in it. It's important to me to live close to where I work in Houston. It's unheard of because it's a really, you know, big spread out city. I lived about 12 minutes from my job. And here in Ithaca, by car, it's about 12 minutes. It's about a 25-minute walk if you do a brisk walk. Mm-hmm. So that's really important because then your whole life isn't made up of, you know, being in your car.
Right. And walking is a great exercise if your body's up to it. You know, it's a great way to. I used to be very proud that I lived 1.25 miles from where I worked for most of the time, and that was a perfect length of a walk twice a day to keep me centered in my mind and my body in good exercise. We're going to take up another song now, and this is going to be Everybody Knows by Sharon Robinson.
It's sung by Sharon Robinson.
It's a
Leonard Cohen song people probably know. Sharon accompanied Leonard Cohen on his last tour, and I love the jazz influence she brings to a song that is kind of biting, but she makes it soft at the same time that it gets across the words of Leonard's poetry.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. And everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody's got that broken feeling. Their father or their dog just died. Everybody's talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful. Give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet. But there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows, everybody knows, that's how it goes. Everybody knows, everybody knows, everybody knows, that's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that it's now or never. Everybody knows that it's me or you. Everybody knows that you live forever when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.
That was Sharon Robinson singing Leonard Cohen's Everybody Knows. And this is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and you're listening to the Made of Clay Report. And today, in this hour, my guest is Kathy Luz Herrera, and we are learning a bit about her life and her passions. She and Patty Sittman have been my guests today, and we're using this time to get to know them as persons, what their passions are, what their life experiences have been, and how we can know them better. And as they prepare for the primary, which will be on Tuesday. So, Kathy, what needs attention here? What issues do you, as a human being, care about, and you know, broader than your political life, but just but also that too. But what do you care about?
Well, I'll start off by saying how grateful I am that we have community radio here. One of the things when I first moved here, there was no jazz station at all. Being an urban person, I was bereft. But having WRFI, we had Pacifica in Houston when I was growing up, and music's important to me. And I'm really glad that that y'all are here and that we're getting a chance to do this, and that you would reach out to us is cool.
Well, this was total serendipity to be able to have you and Patty on the show. It's something I thought about years ago, is wanting to be able to do. I'd never done radio until 3 months ago. I've never run the board, so I'm a little sketchy at this at times, and there, you'll be losing us from time to time. But we find each other, and that's part of what it means to learn to be part of the community.
is now, bearing with us. Now, what did you ask again? What do we need?
Okay. What do you care about? You know, as a human being, what issues, what concerns kind of keep you mulling, keep you thinking, keep you acting in the world?
Well, that is what life is to me, is being active and being an active participant in your life and in your community.
Yes, well, that tends to be self-determination. That's a big issue.
Yeah, but, you know, for the average working person, especially nowadays when, you know, holding one job isn't really enough, especially if you have to work minimum wage jobs and you have to work three jobs, you know, you come home and you're exhausted. And so there's a way that it's a luxury to be able to have that awareness and that commitment to community. And for me, being a member of a labor union has really facilitated me having a good life. I believe in collective bargaining. And I believe that especially in today's multi-corporate world where there's a corporate personhood, and I believe that the huge corporations are like vampires. They're going to live forever. They're sucking the life out of everything resource-wise, and they're lowering the wages to the lowest common denominator in many ways that they can. I think it's up to us to organize, whether it's to prevent fracking or to find ways to collectively have local commerce, you know, grow our own food, have local artisans, small businesses. I think all this is what's really important, and that stuff drives me because it's related to community and it's related to inclusion and broad groups of people getting together for common reasons.
Right, and that emphasizes the common piece in the word community, but most of your examples emphasize the society piece, where things are professionalized, they're paid for, and they're organized, and they're highly controlled or regulated, and that's the society side. Usually, the community side is informal, unpaid labor, your avocation, what you do. You know, most of our lives are spent in labor that's not compensated, whether we're taking courses and studying, or whether we're caring for a friend or a relative or a parent or a child, or just cleaning our house or cleaning our yard or whatever. Most of our lives are spent in unpaid labor, and we haven't figured out how to do the balance. And, you know, corporations slough off to us whatever they don't want to pay for, and that becomes stuff that we have to take care of, and they pay us the lowest wage they can in that model. But how do we take a good balanced look? I know that may not be a question you've thought about, but it's something that we here in Ithaca, we're really quick to identify what the institutional social issues are, but the community issues are oftentimes these unpaid things, and it's tough to find a balance. You were saying that the person working three jobs doesn't have time to really be part of a community, and that's really true unless they have a group of people around them who's really kind of cheering them on. And the people that I've known who've successfully worked three jobs have had, you know, children or older folks in their lives who have been there to kind of encourage them, because they know what kind of hell it is, but they also know that they can't not do it. You know what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying, and I agree with a lot of it. There's a few things that I would expand upon, and one of them is the notion of community. You know, in my culture, as in a lot of people's culture, your grandparents lived with you, and you know, your family. It was understood that your family would help take care of your kids, you know, as you were growing up and starting out, and that's not so common anymore. And the elder care issues, a lot of them stem from the fact that we're having to take care of, or we choose to take care of our parents, whether that's at home or in a nursing home. Those are okay, you could say they're societal issues, but they hit home, and they're not just for my generation. You know, child care is hugely expensive. But to get back to what you were calling unpaid labor, I find it interesting because, you know, my dad always said that there's dignity in work, any kind of work, and whether you're getting paid for it or not, if you're bored, you're not paying attention. And it's true. You know, I've been able to do all kinds of repetitive work and manual work throughout my life, and you can find it stimulating, and you can be fulfilled in it. But the part that I was thinking about is, you know, it wasn't until the 80s or so that we had these 1,000 points of light, and there was so much emphasis on nonprofits doing work that used to be done by government. And it, I believe, was a big change in our economic base, because there was the assumption that because government was more expensive, that it was bad, that what it was doing was inefficient because it wasn't done the way business is done, and that the economic model of profit would be better, a better way to do government. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that all those assumptions are exactly correct. As a matter of fact, I think most of them are completely wrong, because the purpose of government is not to make a profit. The purpose of government isn't to squeeze the most work out of everyone that you possibly can. The purpose of government is for us to find ways to support each other in the times of our life that are hard. Mm-hmm. And we do that very well, but I believe that currently the system, the economic system, is broken to such an extent that it's very hard for government to do that as well.
Right. And I think that one of the things that, and this is where kind of a good leftist critique was, the you had systems of production and systems of reproduction, and systems of production are paid. Systems of reproduction are very often not paid, because labor has value, but it's not always remunerated, because you can't put an exact dollar value on the care that you're providing for a child or a parent, and or even when you're studying, you don't necessarily know what it's going to be worth down the road, but you do it because you are compelled to do it. We need to ask a lot of questions that we've kind of drifted for the past 60 or 70 years as a culture in terms of these commitments that you're raising, these issues that you're raising. We just need to get real, I think, a lot more clear about it, because we're not there yet. We don't know how to deal with each other.
But the other thing my dad impressed upon me is, you know, you can be concerned about your community and want mm-hmm. it to be better, but that doesn't mean that you don't love it. You have to participate in your life mm-hmm. and be an active participant in your community and your life, and that's a joy. That kind of labor, like learning, mm-hmm. those are luxuries and joys that some of us can take on as a lifelong passion.
And if you take it on as joy, you take it on as curiosity, huh. and not as fear. Mm-hmm. And that's, we need to learn this as a culture, because we are so much, regardless of what your politics, we are so much driven by fear of the other, or of the corporation, or of the needs of others, that we don't want to recognize as honest needs, because we don't recognize them as people. You know, so we have so much that we need to do, but we can't do it through fear, and we've got to find a way to turn that. Sorry for the sermon, but I'm also a preacher.
It's perfect. In recovery, we have a saying: anger is fear announced. And I think that a lot of the politics nowadays is driven by fear of other.
Right, and anger is a signal emotion. It's incredibly important that we know our anger, because it tells us something's wrong. It doesn't tell us what to do, but it tells us that something needs attention. And we have to figure that one out. Now, I want to switch to your next song, which is Tightrope, I believe.
Janelle Monáe.
Yeah, yeah.
Monáe and left foot. Keep on. advantage, cause I'm cautious with the scrap. Do damage to your cabbage that a doctor cannot pass. See why you don't want no friction like the back of a matchbook. That if ass will fold you and your MacBook. Close shows shut you down before we go backwards. Act up, and whether we high or low, we gonna get back up like the Dow Jones and NASDAQ. Sort of like a thong and man crack. Come on.
I took bone alligators and little rattlesnakers, but I'm another flavor, something like a Terminator. Ain't no equivocating.
And that was Janelle Monáe and Tightrope. And my guest in this hour is Kathy Luz Herrera. And we're going to turn to some kind of, you know, tough questions. And I'm going to ask the question three different ways. And that way both Kathy can kind of sit with it, but she's already had it. But also the listener can hear it in different ways. What have you learned that forced you to change? What have you learned from your experience that forced you to change a deeply held commitment? Have you learned that something you thought was true was not? Have you grown suspicious of your past and current core commitments? Or how can you hold them but also be suspicious of even your own instincts?
I was saying to you before that these are all kind of the same question, and I was kind of grappling with how to approach this. You know, you can go deep or not. And I think I'm going to go ahead and talk about... When I was young, I was raised Catholic, and my folks allowed me to go to lots of different religious things because they wanted us to be able to pick. I think my mom was Pentecostal before she married my dad. And
strong Pentecostal roots in the Latino community.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so I got to go to synagogues, and my first Seder was with a Girl Scout friend of mine, Barbara Levine, and encountering gefilte fish for the first time and, you know, getting some guidance on you know, what's going on with that. I kind of like them now. Crazy, but it's good stuff. And also, you know, went to Presbyterian Church, Universalist, Unitarians, Methodist, Baptist, lots of Baptists in Texas. Okay, so I'm raised Catholic, and at a certain point I'm experimenting as a young adult, even though I was openly gay. This is another fact of life that a lot of lesbians, a lot of gay people experiment. I thought I was pregnant. As a Catholic, that put me in a huge quandary because I had strongly hewed to the notion that women shouldn't get abortions. Mm-hmm. And I had to grapple with it on a personal level that I had never imagined I would. And I have what could be called a personal relationship with God, in the sense that I found that there's a backstop for me in believing in a higher power, mm-hmm. one that allows me to question my motives and check in to find out where my actions are consistent with my beliefs. And I recognize that as a philosophical and moral struggle. And then I thought back to when I figured out I was gay and how I had recognized that God loves me. Mm-hmm. God loves me as a woman. God loves me as a worker. Being my whole self is what God loves, and I recognize that it would be inauthentic for me not to move forward with that thought process. And it was very difficult because, it was difficult, but I got through it, and I questioned my motives. Was I just doing this because I thought it, you know, because it was more convenient? And I recognized that I would have to grapple with the moral implications mm-hmm. of it. Am I a bad person if I'm choosing to do something that before I thought was wrong? And that's been something that happens sometimes in life. And I think it's a growth opportunity, but it sure isn't when you're having those dark nights of the soul. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's one example. Another quick one I'll give is, okay, I'm in the gay community. I'm a lesbian. Sometimes, you know, women... they called it going straight, right? Women start going with men. Well,
right.
Fine. Sometimes couples break up. Well, in some of the more insular communities, there was this notion that you would ostracize them. You would either pick one friend or the other. That happens in heterosexual communities, mm-hmm. too, I'm sure. Yep. Or that if a woman goes straight, she's betrayed her sisters. you know what, that one, it didn't take me too long to figure out was just wrong. And I've openly been accepting of people that experience their sexuality in different ways, including heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. And that's led me to some thoughts around transgender things. There's an article that my mentor and friend Roe Thorpe wrote that I put a link to on my Facebook page, and it's called something provocative, like "Where Have All the Butches Gone?" You know, growing up in the 50s as I did, right. I identify as butch, and I still do. It's politically incorrect. You know, at a certain point, you just decide. You know, young people call themselves queer, and you know, I called myself a dyke, and that was the way of being provocative. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyway, her article is great because it raises some interesting questions that we've grappled with in the gay and lesbian community about people that transition and decide that maybe they're not gay after they've transitioned. And it really provocative article, and it's a thought process that many of us that are old school, we were worried about, you know, if a woman's if a lesbian decides that she wants to transition, you know, is she still a lesbian? Is she still gay? Is she still queer? And it's good to travel through those intellectual evolutions.
Right. And as we have the technology to actually make those transitions possible from male to female physiological genders or female, it changes our whole notion of what we hold permanent. I had an experience similar to yours in terms of my own spiritual awakening or awareness. I grew up in a congregation in the Midwest that was theologically pretty old school, pretty traditional, but it was a progressive community, and this community had a woman mayor in 1922, 2 years after the passage of suffrage. And this woman had been a lawyer. She went to college, which was not totally uncommon in that community in those days. It was less common actually in the 1950s than it was in the 1910s in some ways. But she learned lawyering from her dad, became grandfathered into the Bar Association, was a postmistress of King City during World War I, and she lived her whole life with another woman, and she was a member of the congregation. She couldn't be an elder because women couldn't be elders, but then elders never met without her because she went as the secretary, and because she was not married, she didn't have a man to influence the process, so she knew she had to be there. And they never met without her until she went into a nursing home at about the age of 90.
Wow.
And that's the kind of resolve that I grew up around. And there was a couple of men who, one was a superintendent of schools of a neighboring district, and the other one was a farmer. And the superintendent of school was an elder in the congregation because as a man, he could be an elder. And the farmer was a deacon, and those two roles fit their personalities. An elder is one who helps with policy and teaching and counseling, and a deacon does the direct service kinds of activities. And they spent their whole lives together, and nobody ever challenged them openly, to my knowledge. And that's the kind of community that I grew up in. Granted, nobody was really out. I grew up in the 60s. I'm a few years younger than you, but I was born in the 50s. But these people were born in the 1880s and 90s. And they had full lives, I believe, from what I could see and from what we knew. And they had wonderful relationships with many, many people. We became a much more rigid country as we got to the middle 20th century than we may have been 50 years before, at least in some of these pockets of communities where things happened because people knew they had to take care of each other.
Why do you think that happened?
Because in one of the tensions between society and community is society is systemically focused, and you tend to see yourself as having to suffer with or be subject to the forces that are beyond your control, so you have to, conformity is the issue. Whereas in community, your personality and how you create the world you live into is the core issue. Because within community, that's person-based as opposed to institution-based in society. You see what I'm saying? And that was a community that knew it was a community. It didn't do institutional stuff real well. Sometimes it got into personalism, which doesn't treat people well because you think you know what they need or you don't take them seriously for other reasons, but not because of institutionalized issues, if you know what I mean. Not because they don't show up on your radar.
That's profound. I get to chew on that.
So anyway, that's a bit of what your example is pretty powerful. And how have you come to see the notion of life and honoring life and honoring choice as you have matured?
I see community as a service and it as a joyous thing where we, you know, help each other out and empower people, let people empower themselves. And for me, you know, I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee, mm-hmm. On the legislature, and have been for some time this year. I'm vice chair. And you get to know things about what's going on in the community and what the community needs are. For example, as a result of the gas drilling and oil drilling in Pennsylvania, one of the problems that's coming into Tompkins County that most people may not be aware of unless you're in the Health and Human Services community is there's trafficking in young people, women, girls, and boys, and I'm talking young.
Mm-hmm. And
children. Yes. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking, and we've got to do things about it. There's other aspects of service that relate to community, a lot of them for me having to do with youth, because as a young person, you know, I had interesting experiences, and I always felt lucky in that I came out on top. But, you know, the world isn't kind to people who don't conform, even today. Mm-hmm. But to me, being an authentic person is a really important part of it. So I've been lucky that I had the strength of character that my folks raised me to understand that, you know, you can contribute to a community even if it has institutional, like you were saying,
right.
issues, because personally, people have so much more in common. You go after where your common interests are. Everybody wants.
Oh, yeah, and I think I'm challenging one thing quickly because
sure.
we are coming late. In a community, I grew up in a place where people would do for others things that they would find abhorrent for themselves, but they knew that the other needed it.
Give me an example.
For example, there were a few fellows who were hermits, in effect. They were people with mental health issues. There were not strong mental health programs in an isolated rural area. They lived reasonably well on their own, but they needed to come into town to buy some goods every once in a while. And they would walk into town, but it's a long walk. It's 4 miles, and so people would give them rides. And they would also arrange to give them rides back home. But this particular person was very anxious and would urinate on the seat if they sat in the car. Mm. So they would try to figure out how to kind of have them in the back of the pickup truck, and that wasn't trying to condescend to them, but they also didn't want to have to put up with cleaning up their car afterwards, and that was the best way they could figure to do it. And also, you know, people would understand you didn't have, this was before we had certain kinds of food benefits, and the grocers would basically have a box where the chits went into. And they would write them off, or they would ask people about them, but they were not particularly coercive, and it was relatively discreet. And that's just kind of the way a community functioned. And I've also seen people who don't believe in abortion, for example, support a person in an abortion decision, because mm-hmm. that is where they are. They're there for the person. Now, people are going to be offended on all sides by that example, because it pisses people off in whether you think it should be just of right and no second guessing, or it shouldn't be at all. But we live across these divides where our moral judgments are going to go in opposite directions. And if we can't support each other, then we don't take each other seriously.
And isn't life more interesting when you have people in your life that are different than you?
Right. It's more interesting. It is profoundly painful, but it's real. And when we want people to agree with our policies or our practices, we take away the real. Because we don't have to live in different ways with each other. I don't have to adjust how I am to fit you, because I treat you like any other person, but you're not any other person. You're you. And we lose that kind of, and we need a political system where we recognize that there are millions of yous in this country who need things, and we need to be there, as you said, as a community for each other.
I wish we had another half hour. Just quickly, I'll say
sure.
that there are people in this community that do things like writing off those chits. Now, we have people in those community like the hermits that you talked about. There's still a generosity of community that doesn't get on the radar of people that aren't proclaiming what they're doing. But it's true that it's not like it used to be. And there's a way that Obama talked about this. Mm-hmm. He said, when he was talking about, I would call it diversity, he was saying it's uncomfortable when we're together with people that don't have the same life experiences than us. It's going to be uncomfortable, mm-hmm. but we're better for it. And that's what I think I bring to the legislature and to the community, is an understanding that people are different, and a way of trying to represent the voices of people that aren't necessarily heard from. Whether I agree with those notions or not, a democratic discussion, I believe, has to include some of mm-hmm. that, whether it's folks that are concerned about gun control. Okay, you're giving
me
the...
No. I respond physically, so keep talking.
that's a lot of what I'm about. Actually, if you look at my voting record, I more consistently vote with the majority than not, but I often bring up issues that aren't addressed in public debate. They may have been discussed beforehand and cast aside by the majority, but I think it's important that the public sees that these things have been discussed and why they were, you know, not necessarily accepted as part of the legislation or resolution or program.
So they have to become clear and in public about those judgments or those prejudices or whatever.
Because things change. Yeah. We didn't have a non-discrimination ordinance, mm-hmm. you know, before the 80s.
Right.
And things have changed. It took a lot of work mm-hmm. to get those changes, a lot of uncomfortable conversations.
I want to go back to one thing that you said about the a community in the olden days. There were really no olden days. This tension has always been at play. And in Ithaca, in the late 19th century, as in this entire country, many institutionalized charities were brought into being, and that was the first generation of public charities. That was in the face of the death of these more organic communities. And also it was a status thing to be able to do the charity, and people wanted to be known. And now sometimes people don't want to be known because they don't want to take the flack that comes. They don't want the status piece, because that's a mature reaction.
Yes.
But it's also, we need to be known in order to be examples in each other's lives, so that we can learn from each other how to live. So being known without adulation and without condemnation is something that we need to learn, I think, to do as a community. That's kind of our next step. We haven't figured it out. There hasn't been much in the way of a community in the organic since the Civil War in Tompkins County. And most of the expressions of it are ethnic-based or institutional-based. But the organic community really hasn't been here for a long, long time. And I think we're poised, because there is interest. People want to talk about community, though they very often only mean a place. They don't mean substance, and that's...
It's so provocative. So, there's so much to say there, but I'll just say briefly,
sure.
Churches serve that role. But like you said, there's ethnic lines. But again, community doesn't have to be just people that I feel agree with me, or that I'm most comfortable with, or that I have the most that I know of in common.
Yeah.
You find out that you have a lot in common with people. Just briefly... folks like the Rotary Club and other organizations, mm-hmm. they do a lot of that stuff in a more organizational way mm-hmm. that's supported. And it's a good way, I think, for people to be able to plug into.
And it's one
like
way.
That. Yeah, it's
but
one
it's
way.
Not, but it's not that informal piece. And you said something about community. Community is where the fights matter. You can walk, you can walk away and say, I just don't agree with you, then it's not a community. But communities are where the fights matter. And that's where the differences matter, and I think we've forgotten.
The personal is political.
Right. Yes, the same thing. Kathy, it's been wonderful to have you here this morning. I'm going to cut to your last, you have 15 songs. We don't have time for 15 songs, but the West Side of Town, Tish Hinojosa. Do you want to say something before? But thank you for appearing with me. Would you like to say something about the song before we...
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a good Texas musician singing about campesinos, her family, immigrants, and the beautiful joy that comes from living the life that you chose.
Thank you, Kathy.
Cars and worked the wars and raised a family.
And that's Tish Hinojosa and the West Side of Town. And our guests this morning on the Made of Clay Report have been Patty Sipman and Kathy Luz Herrera. And they are two candidates in the Democratic primary for a legislator from the Fall Creek area, District 2 in the county legislature. And this is WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And we have taken this show today as an effort to try to get to know these people as people and focus less on the issues of the district than the persons who may be representing us. Getting to know each other is part of the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. Now we're going to return to some programming on the show Electric Chakra is not going to be on, but there is some music queued up to play.